From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
You know, the U.S. Marines. I mean, this is pretty basic to America, and I think we ought to show some hospitality.
Allow this to happen in our communities is frightening for the future. The future is going to be militarized. And, you know, I mean, Mayor Brown, out of all people.
The U.S. Marines land in Oakland. We'll find out why. Also, residents of Los Angeles and Oakland file suit against the CIA and Justice Department, saying they did nothing to stop the introduction of crack cocaine into their communities. And Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey remembers Northern Irish human rights lawyer Rosemary Nelson. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The car bomb assassination of Rosemary Nelson, a prominent lawyer who defended IRA suspects, was designed to halt Northern Ireland's peace process. This, according to politicians yesterday, as local police asked the FBI to help in the investigation. Nelson died on Monday, 2 hours after a bomb blew apart her car as she drove away from her home in Lurgan, 30 miles southwest of Belfast. An anti-Catholic terror group calling itself the Red Hand Defenders claimed responsibility. British Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Mallam said those who killed Rosemary Nelson did so because they thought it would destroy the Good Friday Agreement. She was a brave woman who stood up for what she believed in. White House Press Secretary Joe Lockhart read a statement from Clinton calling the bombing a despicable and cowardly act by the enemies of peace. About 500 people carrying black flags and candles walked in silence yesterday to Mrs. Nelson's office in the center of Lurgan, where they prayed and left flowers and candles. She's expected to be buried tomorrow. Finnish forensic scientist Helena Ranta said today the deaths of 40 Albanians in the Kosovo village of Racak were a crime against humanity. The head of the International Monitors in Kosovo, William Walker, provoked fury from the Yugoslav authorities when he declared that the Racak killings were a massacre by Serb police. He also called them a crime against humanity for which he said the Yugoslav authorities were responsible. Serb police said the dead were all killed in fighting and that ethnic Albanian guerrillas had manipulated the scene to make it look like a massacre. Britain's top court said today it would announce in a week's time whether former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, arrested in London 5 months ago on a Spanish warrant, must face extradition proceedings. Pinochet will be freed if the court, known as the Law Lords, decides on March 24th that his arrest was not legal. Otherwise, he will face proceedings to extradite him to Spain, where he's wanted on charges of torture and conspiracy to murder thousands. Pinochet was arrested in his hospital bed in connection with crimes allegedly committed during his 1973 to 1990 iron-fisted rule in Chile. Among the 3,000 people who died or vanished during his rule were dozens of Spaniards. Yesterday, Palestinians urged U.S. President Bill Clinton not to be influenced by congressional resolutions calling on him to oppose any unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state. The House of Representatives voted 380-24 Tuesday in favor of the resolution, which the Senate approved last week. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who suspended a U.S. brokered land for security deal last December over alleged Palestinian violations, opposes a Palestinian state and has made the issue a plank in his bid for re-election on May 17th. Seven leaders of the anti-government Montana Freemen were sentenced to stiff prison terms for conspiring against the nation's banking system, though a judge spared more jail time for two of the defendants' wives. A U.S. district judge ordered ringleader Leroy Schweitzer to 22.5 years behind bars yesterday, hoping to send a loud and clear message to those who, quote, pass this hatred and ugliness around. Intel is promising to share its computer chip technology with other companies as part of a deal settling its antitrust case with the government. In return, people familiar with the deal say government prosecutors won't force Intel to admit that it holds monopoly power over the microprocessor market. That's a victory for the chip maker, since the kind of admission could have been used against Intel in future lawsuits. The agreement was announced last week, but details were closely guarded at the time. The Federal Trade Commission is expected to announce terms of the settlement today. Some of the nation's most prestigious colleges want to make sure their names aren't on caps and sweatshirts made in overseas sweatshops for pennies a day. 17 schools, including Harvard, Brown, Princeton, Duke, this week joined a national group set up to curb worker abuses overseas. The schools made the announcement 2 weeks after protesters across the nation, many of them students, demonstrated against corporate giants for allegedly abusing overseas workers. But student activists said yesterday they were outraged by the move because the group, the Fair Labor Association, is supported largely by apparel manufacturers such as Nike and Philips Van Heusen.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners across the country.
Well, it is a sad St. Patrick's Day around the country as people today both celebrate St. Patrick's Day but also remember Rosemary Nelson. Northern Ireland's predominantly Protestant police force faces allegations that it rejected a request to protect human rights lawyer Rosemary Nelson, who was killed on Sunday by a car bomb outside her home in Lurgan, 30 miles away from Belfast. Nelson had represented a number of defendants accused of belonging to the Irish Republic Army. The Red Hand Defenders, an anti-Catholic group, had claimed responsibility for the killing. Representatives of Sinn Féin yesterday accused Northern Ireland's police, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, of culpability in Nelson's death, saying the force had refused to provide security for Nelson's protection. Protesters who took to the streets in the hours after the murder also accused the police force of complicity in the murder. The RUC flatly denied that any application for protection had ever been made on Nelson's behalf. These charges came as Northern Ireland's police chief, Sir Ronnie Flanagan, announced the British police would head the investigation into Nelson's killing, and he also requested help from the FBI here in the United States. We're joined right now by Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey, a human rights activist well known from Northern Ireland and close friend of Rosemary Nelson. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bernadette.
Hi, Emma.
Thank you for joining us. As usual, your phone is quite fuzzy. I'm not sure.
We can't do a lot about that. I think it has more to do with police surveillance than distance.
Well, tell us about Rosemary Nelson, your friend.
Well, I think the first thing that has to be clearly understood is Rosemary Nelson was first and foremost a human being. Very, very brave young woman, human rights lawyer, who has worked in that capacity throughout the duration of the war. She was also the mother of three children whose ages are from 11 into their mid-teens. And like many, indeed like most human rights activists, and particularly lawyers in this country, she was always under threat. And the issue was not simply that the RUC, the local police, failed to offer her protection. That would be a very minor charge in this community. But that the RUC were actually involved over a long period of time in threatening Rosemary Nelson themselves. And in fact, there had been a United Nations investigation here, and the United Nations rapporteur who came interviewed Rosemary Nelson and expressed grave concern about the dangers under which she operated. As a result of that, Rosemary was encouraged by the United Nations team to make formal complaints to the police. These were investigated by the RUC with such just abandonment of any principle that even the police commission here, the Independent Police Commission, as a result of that, expressed such dissatisfaction at the police investigation into the dangers that Rosemary faced that they called in an English police investigating team.
Bernadette.
And that team is simply reporting next week on whether or not Rosemary's life was actually in danger. Of course, she's dead now.
Bernadette, if there's any way, I'm not quite sure how to make your voice clearer. We always have this problem with you, and as you've always said, that it has to do with the police tapping your phone.
I'm not sure how you do it. I can try and shout even louder.
Yeah, that would be good. Juan?
What type, when you say that the Royal Ulster Police were complicit, what kind of treatment had they historically given to her, aside from the threats? How had they dealt with her in her legal activities?
Well, Rosemary Wood have, as a number of lawyers, including Pat Finucan, who was also killed a number of years ago, would have defended members of, in fact, she defended the poor. She did not simply defend members of paramilitary organizations. She defended all those people whose human rights were violated. Because she defended members of the IRA or suspected members of the IRA, she was accused by the police quite openly of membership of illegal organizations herself. Information about her was given to loyalist organizations. Her clients, when being interrogated in interrogation centers, were given messages of the most vulgar and vile nature against her physical safety, and often, as they do in these circumstances, containing the most vulgar sexual abuse and inference as well, passed on through her client to her from interrogators and police. As I say, there was serious concern about Rosemary's safety, but how do you ask the organisation whom you suspect of monitoring her activity, which the police do, they have a legal right to do that, monitor her movements, stop her at roadblocks, how do you ask those people who are collecting the information vital to attacking her to protect her from themselves? On the evening that Rosemary, on the day that Rosemary was killed, she had in fact been working on providing a joint approach on the racist killings in London, the death of Steve Lawrence, with a racist killing here, the kicking to death of a young man, Robert Hamill, while the police stood and looked on. And she was preparing civil prosecution against the individual police officers who stood and watched this young man being kicked to death. She had worked, in fact, I had been speaking with a number of British human rights activists who then went to see Rosemary, and she'd worked on compiling a number of strategic approaches and done a major story for a local newspaper, which appeared the morning she was killed. She then went for the weekend to Donegal. Her older children were off on holiday. She went for the weekend to Donegal, and when she came back, there was a very short time space between that and her death. But when she came back, the area in which she lived had been saturated by the security forces. There was a security helicopter hovering over the area. And within that time frame, somebody put a very sophisticated weapon or bomb device right onto the driver's seat of her car, as a result of which, when she drove it and activated the brake at a road junction, the car blew up. She lost both her legs in the explosion and died a short time after in hospital. Now, it is inconceivable that within the level of security that operated within the 48 hours before her death around her house, that anybody could have been there without the knowledge of the security forces. We're not talking about complicity or collusion on the fringes. We're talking about active participation in the killing of people like Rosemary, and the killing of Rosemary because, from the state's point of view, there isn't anything else you do with people like Rosemary. You intimidate her and she doesn't stop. You threaten her and she doesn't stop. You try to limit her professional capacity by making accusations against her person and professional integrity, and she doesn't stop. And all the time she exposes the corruption of the state. All the time she exposes the complicity of the state in violent murder. And so at some point, in order to stop Rosemary, the state has to kill her. And they did.
What is your impression of what impact this is going to have on the peace process at this stage?
At this stage, quite frankly, I don't care. What I care about is that Rosemary is dead. The peace process actually doesn't involve itself very deeply with the human rights issues that Rosemary did. The peace process will no doubt survive. Rosemary won't. And I don't think that it is in the thinking. I mean, what has to be questioned here is what are the bona fides of a government that is involved in the peace process and is actively involved in the killing of the citizens with whom it's supposed to be making peace?
I understood that the request for security, Rosemary Nelson's request for security, went right up to Tony Blair.
Well, those are things, Amy, I wouldn't have detailed information on. I think that kind of information can only be elicited by an outside independent and United Nations inquiry. I mean, nobody else here, not that I trust the United Nations that much, but nobody else here trusts anybody else. There's no point in asking the police to answer that question. They're already lying about the number of requests or the extent of the danger that Rosemary was in. I think there has to be an open production of all documentation. What did Tony Blair know? What conversations did he have about Rosemary? What did Ronnie Flanagan, the head of the police, know? What did he ever say to or about Rosemary? In regard to, as I say, there is hopefully to be published in the space of the next 14 days a report, which is currently with the Department of Public Prosecution, a report setting out the extent of police inadequacy, police involvement, police refusal to deal with the threat against Rosemary Nelson. I mean, this was not one threat. This woman lived her life under the cloud of persistent awareness that she was going to be killed because she operated within the law with professional, impartial integrity on the side of those people whose human rights were being violated, particularly by the state, and against a background where she was not the first human rights lawyer in this country to be killed for doing that work.
Well, Bernadette Devlin McCallisky, we want to thank you very much for joining us from Coal Island. I know that you yourself face continuous harassment and threats against you. You yourself have been shot up when the police were supposedly protecting your house, standing outside, and yet people got in and shot up you and your husband.
Yeah, I think those of us who work in this field know that the state will ultimately intimidate some of us, buy off some of us, and those of us who can neither be intimidated or bought off, either we build a country we can live in, or this country will kill us all.
Bernadette Devlin McCallisky speaking to us from Coal Island in Northern Ireland, a close friend of Rosemary Nelson, the Irish human rights lawyer who will be buried tomorrow, and will continue to bring you more on her story. Coming up on Democracy Now!, we're going to look here at home at Marines practicing urban warfare in Oakland, California. And we're also going to be looking at a lawsuit that's been brought against the U.S. government, specifically the Justice Department and the Central Intelligence Agency, for not preventing the introduction of crack cocaine into communities of color in this country, particularly in Oakland and in South Central Los Angeles. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute.
Abandoned by your church, I've watched you suffer. Now you're older than your years, but you still look beautiful, though you're fighting back the tears. You couldn't break down my door.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Marines practicing urban warfare are fighting a make-believe enemy at a former naval air station and hospital in Oakland, California. In an operation called Urban Warrior, the Marines landed in Oakland this weekend and reenacted an invasion, shooting blanks and using hovercraft and Harrier jets, as well as Sea Knight, Sea Stallion, Cobra, and Huey helicopters. They'll remain in the East Bay area until tomorrow. The Marines have encountered opposition from local residents and peace activists, as well as environmental defenders, who say the exercises are extremely damaging to the East Bay's fragile ecosystem. Hundreds of actors were bused in to participate in the exercises. The Marines say these exercises are intended to train their troops for the type of conflict they'll encounter in foreign commitments in the early 21st century. They also cite humanitarian and disaster relief operations as part of the training operation. Activists are particularly incensed at Oakland Mayor Jerry Brown, who's usually associated with the peace movement, but who Oakland residents say authorized the Marine exercises without the approval of the Oakland City Council. Mayor Brown has cited a windfall of about $4.5 million to the local economy for the exercise. We're going to begin first with a report produced at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley by Rich Perry.
Shortly after 9 a.m. this morning, Sea Knight, Sea Stallion, Cobra, and Huey helicopters descended from the sky to the seaplane ramp at the former Alameda Naval Station, now known as Alameda Point. They were followed shortly by the arrival of hovercraft vehicles, where a total of 700 Marines disembarked to begin the Bay Area component of Operation Urban Warrior. The exercises officially began on Saturday in Monterey. They did not go exactly as planned for the Marines, as the California Coastal Commission intervened last Thursday to prevent the Marines from arriving on hovercraft, saying they would disturb gray whales, snowy plovers, and sea otters. The invasion was followed by the Marines taking Humvees to Oak Knoll, the site of a former military base in the Oakland Hills. However, what the Marines referred to as Block 1 of the three-block war, humanitarian assistance, was scuttled by the military. The Marines' Tim Jones explains why.
We are putting the Marines ashore, and we're going to go to Oak Knoll, and we're going to set up. We aren't actually going to conduct any exercise portions. That is a change from the original schedule, but we've known for a little while now that we're going to have to set up, and we're going to have to conduct the exercise Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Thursday.
There were estimated to be over 120 protesters who congregated at Alameda Point. The decision by Mayor Jerry Brown to allow the Marines to perform their war games in Oakland, after the National Park Service and the Presidio Trust rejected the Marines in San Francisco, has enraged elements of the progressive East Bay community. Miguel Cavilla Moreno said he has lived in other countries where real tanks have rolled through the streets, shooting in anger. He spoke for many when he said he could not believe Jerry Brown had approved the exercises.
Allow this to happen in our communities is frightening for the future. The future is going to be militarized. And, Mayor Brown, out of all people, out of all politicians, I mean, this man has at least given the impression in his, career as being one of humanitarian. I mean, look at this. Before he became mayor, he was a disciple to Mother Teresa in India. Doing work of peace of the people. And he becomes mayor of Oakland, and what does he do? The most destructive war machine in the planet being brought right here to Oakland. I mean, we are not the enemy.
Although many fear the Marines' exercises are in preparation for future military adventures in this country, activist Gloria Lariva said she is worried about what she says is the obvious implications for further foreign interventions.
If you look at the past 15 years of the U.S. invasions, actually past 14 years, each war exercise that was publicized like this was a plan for an imminent invasion like Panama, Grenada, and others as well. So we have very much reason to worry about this.
The San Francisco environmental group Arc Ecology attempted to stop the exercises late last week, but were rebuffed by a U.S. District Court judge on Friday, citing insufficient evidence. Hank Chapeau is an Oakland resident who observed the hovercraft landing. He says he did a survey of the lagoon at Alameda Point an hour and a half before the landing and said the shoreline was relatively clear. But afterwards,
the hovercraft, which were the size of apartment buildings, stirred up the debris from the former Navy base, which includes heavy metals, benzenes, chlorine, organochemicals, and everything you would find in an industrial zone like that. And it's headed for the bay. I know this lagoon is flushed by the tidal action.
One Alameda police officer said that nearly everybody in the police force was assigned to today's beginning of Urban Warrior. 10 helmeted members of the Alameda SWAT team were present at all times near the protesters, which to the Center for Conscientious Objectors, Chris Lombardi, was a slight case of overkill.
And I don't know what they expect. I think they're expecting us to respond to violence with violence, and that's just not what we're about.
The Coalition Against Urban Warfare plans another protest tomorrow when Urban Warrior continues at the former Oak Knoll Hospital. Mitch Perry, KPFA News, Oakland.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! While we were not able to get Mayor Jerry Brown of Oakland on with us live, we were able to get this recorded message from Jerry Brown explaining why he invited the Marines into Oakland.
They're actually coming ashore in Alameda. In the city of Oakland, they're going to use the military property, the Oak Knoll Naval Hospital. It belongs to the military. It's up there, not being used. And quite frankly, the U.S. Marines. I mean, this is pretty basic to America, and I think we ought to show some hospitality. Also, training-wise, we do get whatever benefits are from emergency preparedness. But most importantly, if we're going to have a Marine Corps, which I don't think more than 3 or 4% of the American people would question, it's got to be trained. And we do have urban warfare. We got urban warfare in Sarajevo and Kosovo. We might have had some. We had some in Rwanda, but the president wimped out, and as a result of not being willing to help, 500,000 people were slaughtered. So there, and we know what happened in Somalia and Mogadishu. So there's no question that urban fighting, street fighting, is part of the 21st century kind of war and difficulty that America is going to face. And secondly, there's no question the Marine Corps is going to be around. And thirdly, there's no question they have to be trained. So the real option here is to take a colonialist position and say, well, not in Oakland. Let them train in Mexico, where we don't have to see them. Or maybe send them over to Africa, where, you know, they won't object. Well, I think that's totally hypocritical. I think it represents a colonialist mind. And if we're going to have a Marine Corps, let's see what they're doing. And let's, right up there in the hills with nice, affluent people, let them partake here, just like poor people would be exposed to these kind of maneuvers. And besides that, it's probably not any noisier than the Super Bowl or, the Chinese parade when they're banging on drums and lighting off thousands of firecrackers. So when you really reduce it, you have an opposition, some that's pacifist, and I respect that. Other is just against the American military. They want it unilaterally eliminated. And I don't agree with that, and I don't think most Oaklanders do. So it just comes down to the simple issue, is Oakland's military property available for training necessary if we're going to have a Marine Corps, which we're going to have?
Oakland Mayor Jerry Brown and former Pacifica radio host here on Democracy Now! As we turn now to some Oakland residents who've been involved with protests, as well as a representative of the Marine Corps. Colonel Gary Anderson is with us, Chief of Staff for the Marine Corps War Fighting Laboratory, which is based in Quantico, Virginia. But he's speaking to us from San Francisco. Can you tell us what the plans are for today in Oakland?
Yeah, I can. I'm not sure where we got the impression that the first block of the war, the humanitarian portion, got canceled. It's going on very strongly there at Oak Knoll. We had a group of journalists come by yesterday and take a look at it. We'll continue to take a look at all three blocks of this situation, peacekeeping, humanitarian, and then a situation where we have to conduct full-scale operations in urban terrain, military-type operations.
Well, Colonel Anderson, I'd like to ask you, I've reported at various times on some of our military operations in places like Panama City during the Panama invasion or Port-au-Prince in Haiti in 94. And of course, there's the example of Mogadishu around the same time as the Haiti situation. Does the military have in all of its bases across the country place for be able to conduct urban warfare exercises?
No, we don't. We have some small what we call urban combat facilities. They're only usually a block wide and a block long, but and you can do some things in there, but it makes it very difficult to simulate the real challenge of urban operations. There's a new book out just got published in March called Black Hawk Down about the fight in Mogadishu in 1993 between the Rangers and the Somalis. And the author asks a very interesting question. He says, why is it that a country that can't put that can put a robot dune buggy on Mars cannot navigate a column of troops through five blocks of urban terrain? That's a good question. That's one of the things we're trying to answer, and we need a larger area than just the little combat facilities we have in our bases.
Well, Colonel Gary Anderson, we're also joined by Marlene Crone, who's with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which is based in Philadelphia and Geneva. She's also a school teacher in the Oakland public school system. Marlene Crone, you've been one of those who've been protesting the Urban Warrior exercise. Why?
Yes, good morning. I am protesting. I shall continue to protest. Basically, as an educator teacher in the school system, I am trying very, very hard to teach our youth that violence is not the answer to conflict. This glamorization of war, this roadshow of futuristic military hardware, it makes it very difficult for me to impress upon our children that this is not the future we see for them.
Now, I understand it's not only the Marines that have come in. Have the Marines brought in actors?
Yes. There were about 200, I believe, actors that were hired to participate in this war game maneuver. Just from the appearance of some of the actors that were boarding the buses, they really represented a large number of people of color. As a matter of fact, it's the first time I've seen that kind of representation of people of color in such a way.
And what's their purpose?
The purpose, they were to be the opposition to the Marines.
They're the enemy.
Yes.
Colonel Anderson, I'd like to ask you, normally aren't in war games usually one group of troops assigned basically to be the opposition to the troops conducting the war games? Why have you brought in actors instead of using your own soldiers to play those roles?
What we're trying to replicate here is not a war game. That's a word that the presser in the Bay has come up with. This is an exercise, an experimental exercise designed to try to replicate the kinds of the 27 military operations that we've seen since the Cold War came to an end, where Marines have had to be employed in urban areas. We don't see armed soldiers. We don't see tanks and guns deployed against us. We see crowds. We see factions. We see people that are for us, against us. Non-governmental relief organizations, CARE and the Red Cross, reporters. It's a chaotic environment where you have to try to solve the problems that come up as well as you can. And I think your caller is absolutely right. The one thing that we've found is if you can get people to talk to you and negotiate, they're usually not shooting at you. Now, sometimes that doesn't happen, and sometimes you run into some really bad guys, and you have to be able to fight. And we in the Marine Corps believe when you have to fight, you fight to win.
Where did you get these actors?
We sent out basically a casting call, just like we would if we were putting out a movie. Let me address the subject of people of color. We are an equal opportunity employer. People come qualified to play the role or the roles and so forth. We're not going to discriminate against them because they happen to be non-white type actors.
As our producer joked, it's probably the largest opportunity for jobs for actors of color that this country has seen in a while.
I think we've probably given a lot of people across the rainbow spectrum a chance for some extra income.
Phyllis Olin is also with us, president of the board of directors of the Western States Legal Foundation, which has opposed Urban Warrior. What are your grounds of opposition, Phyllis Olin?
Hi. Thank you for having me on. It's really hard to disagree with the colonel. It's a wonderful job opportunity, and that is what part of what really upsets us. This is glorifying the military. It has to do with increasing the military presence around the world and supporting corporate interests. If this were really humanitarian and disaster aid, I agree with the colonel completely that the best way to do that is an environment where people can be accommodating and can get along. Sending in the Marines who are trained to kill and destroy is not the way. The Center for Defense Information, which is a body of retired admirals and generals, has recommended that non-governmental organizations like the Red Cross and the Peace Corps be used with a military escort if necessary. I mean, they're not naive. They do understand we live in a violent world. But what the United States is doing is adding to that violence. The training consists of going through cities, urban warfare. That's the main thrust. And it has to do with going around skyscrapers, being in sewers at the same time. This is from the Marine Corps Warfighting Laboratory's own literature. It's about war, and it's about war. Jerry Brown is right. It's an equal opportunity. We can do it here as well as the Third World. We're opposed to both of those. We're not favoring the Third World over the rich neighborhoods of Oakland. Part of what is happening is glorifying war. We're in a city like Oakland, which has a very high crime rate. Mayor Brown came in saying that his priority was to rid the city of violence. Now we're going to have a big festival this coming weekend, the 19th through the 21st, at Jack London Square, where the military hardware will be shown, where the brass bands will play, and where children of Oakland will get to actually touch the weapons and the hardware. There was a city council meeting last night, which actually was very exciting. There were over 300 people there, many of them young high school students who were very articulate, and they said, we don't want the Marine Corps. We don't want those kind of jobs. We want education. We want to be professionals, and we want to do something to support ourselves that helps society. We don't want militarism.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Colonel Anderson. Clearly, I would think that you would disagree with these two guests in terms of the glorification of war. What's your response, though, to them?
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think we've got anybody glorifying war. Her point about the escorting of people trying to deliver relief aid is right on. That's of all of the operations that we've conducted in the past 10 years, the vast majority of them have had some kind of peacekeeping or humanitarian application. And we don't like to fight, but somebody has to know how when you have to. What happens if that relief convoy gets held up by a bunch of thugs? Are you going to turn around and tell some starving kid we don't do windows? No. You're gonna get rid of the bad guys. This situation in Uganda a week ago, where a bunch of American tourists or a group of tourists were attacked, hacked to death, and killed by on a guerrilla watching expedition by real guerrillas with guns, is the kind of world that I deal with. That's my world. That's the world I've seen. I deal with the NGOs, the American Red Cross, the Red Crescent, have done so on many occasions in foreign countries. And I'll tell you one thing. When they get in a situation where they're dealing with those kind of people, it's not a bad thing to see the United States Marines.
Is this also being geared toward U.S. cities in case there are problems there, riots,
absolutely
for example?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is, you know, the scenario in this operation is the country of green. It's asked us in. It's had an earthquake. They've got a lot of violent factions that are trying to overthrow a democratically elected government. We're supporting that government. We're trying to do it as peacefully as we can, but we're prepared to fight if we have to.
Marlene Crone, your response from Women's International League for Peace and Freedom.
Yes. We are not naive as citizens in this country. We also understand that there probably will always be the need for a defense. But when we're talking about things that these atrocities that happen in countries around the world, perhaps the U.S., perhaps if we had different policies, these problems would not exist. We all seem to forget that we have we play a part in the reactions to these policies in other countries. These things don't happen in a vacuum.
Is there a question there that she want a response?
No, just making a comment. And actually, yeah, with that comment, we're going to have to wrap up. I want to thank you all, though, very much for being with us. Marlene Crone, who people were just listening to, a teacher in the Oakland Public Schools. Phyllis Olin, president of the board of directors of the Western States Legal Foundation. And Colonel Gary Anderson, speaking to us from San Francisco, chief of staff for the Marine Corps Warfighting Laboratory. Right now, Urban Warrior, Marines project in Oakland is going forward for another day. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We're actually going to continue with another California story, a suit against the federal government from residents of Oakland and Los Angeles. But before we do this, on this St. Patrick's Day, there is a tradition that goes on in New York at the St. Patrick's Day Parade, and that is oftentimes hundreds of people get arrested because for many years now, lesbians and gay men, Irish lesbians and gay men, have not been able to march as a group in the St. Patrick's Day Parade here in New York. We're now joined from the New York Public Library, the site of those arrests, by John McDonough, who is a radio producer at Pacifica Station WBAI, who does the program Radio Free Erin. Welcome, John.
Yeah, thank you, Amy, for letting me on. I think the good weather is bringing out a lot of people. There's well over 300 people down at the demonstration. Reverend Al Sharpton just showed up a little while ago, and people are just starting to get arrested. This is the ninth year running where ILGO, or the Irish Lesbian Gay Organization, are not allowed to march up Fifth Avenue. And I have to tell you, Amy, it's a lot safer down here with the demonstrators than to be on 86th Street at 4 o'clock, where last year a kid from the Bronx was stomped to death. So they don't mind that, the ancient order of homophobes, but they do mind Irish gays and lesbians marching peacefully.
Well, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, which is the group that runs the parade, has won court battles year after year, saying that it's a private parade and they have a right to exclude people that they want to from the parade. And this is the response that they get. Juan?
A private parade of 2 million people. Now, that's that's amazing.
So how many people are getting arrested now, John?
It's just hard to say because everyone's trying to go out now and block the roadway on Fifth Avenue. You had one of these captains in the police force, you know, telling them that if they go out and block Fifth Avenue, that they will be arrested. Amy, I just wanted to bring up another point. We're doing a special here on BAI about Rosemary Nelson. She was in the BAI studios last year, And during an interview with Radio Free Erin, she stated that one of her clients came out after being interrogated by the RUC, and an RUC man told her that it was no use getting Rosemary Nelson as your lawyer because she won't be around long enough to defend you. So we're going to have that up on the Internet. We have all our shows go up. It's on iraradio.com, and you can hear the whole show in about another day or two and her interview about almost a premonition about her death.
Hmm. Well, John McDonough, I want to thank you for being with us, standing outside the New York Public Library, where hundreds of people plan to get arrested today. Again, as John was saying, the ninth consecutive year where Irish lesbians and gay men and their supporters go out to be arrested because the courts have ruled that the ancient order of Hibernians that run the St. Patrick's Day parade have the right to exclude who they want. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to another issue. City residents who say that the federal government did nothing to stop the introduction of crack cocaine in their neighborhoods in the 1980s have filed a class action suit against the CIA and the Justice Department this week. The federal civil rights lawsuit was filed on behalf of African-American residents of Oakland and Los Angeles whose babies were born addicted to crack, whose relatives died in drug-related violence, and whose communities were affected by crowded emergency rooms, violence in schools, and gutted business districts. The suits are partially prompted by last year's disclosure of a 1982 agreement between the late CIA Director William Casey and the former Attorney General William French Smith that the spy agency had no duty to report drug crimes to the Justice Department. A 1996 series published by the San Jose Mercury News also said a drug ring funneled profits to the U.S.-backed Nicaraguan Contra rebels for the better part of a decade. So far, both agencies have denied the charges in the suit, and the CIA has said it's exonerated by an internal Justice Department investigation last summer. We're joined right now by Katya Kamisarek, who is an attorney representing the plaintiffs. Katya, can you explain this lawsuit?
Let me give it a shot. The lawsuit essentially is a civil rights suit because people's civil rights were violated when the CIA failed to protect them by giving information about the key drug importers and dealers to law enforcement agencies who could have gone and arrested these drug dealers. As the evidence that we already possess from the government's own reports show that the CIA knew during the beginning and height of the crack epidemic who the main drug importers were, at least here on the West Coast. The lawsuits obviously are for people on the West Coast. There are two lawsuits, in fact, one coming out of the Bay Area, the Oakland-San Francisco area, and a second lawsuit for the people in Los Angeles and Compton. The lawsuits are identical, but the geography is different. All the drugs that were coming into all the cocaine that was coming into California in the early 80s, virtually all of it was coming through two Nicaraguan dealers named Blandon and Meneses. And these people were CIA assets. The CIA had reports. They knew what these people were doing. The cocaine, the powder cocaine, was then transferred to a dealer named Ricky Ross. Ricky Ross turned it into crack cocaine and flooded South Central Los Angeles with it. South Central Los Angeles is a largely African-American area. The crack cocaine, which is the most highly addictive form of cocaine, ravaged the entire community. Children were becoming addicted. People died of overdoses. There was a massive increase in drug-related crime. Businesses fled. Neighborhoods were turned into war zones. And this was not only predictable based on historical experience, as with the British use of opium in China or heroin in the ghetto in the United States during the Vietnam War. But the situation with the crack became readily obvious in the early 80s. Newspaper headlines were talking about the disaster within a year or so of crack's arrival, and yet the CIA continued to protect the importers and the primary dealer. What the CIA should have done and could have done would have been to call the Los Angeles police, call the Oakland police, call the FBI, call the DEA, and say, here are the names of the key importers. This is the main dealer. Go get them. But they didn't do that. They sat on this knowledge, and as a result, I mean, where the epidemic could have been nipped in the bud or aborted early, they did nothing, and people died as a result. Families were destroyed.
And Katya Komisaruk, of course, the infamous memo, this 1982 agreement between then CIA Director Bill Casey and then Attorney General William French Smith, which really only came to light as a result of the investigation prompted by the initial Gary Webb series, that Dark Alliance series, has gotten very little attention. I know Congress member Maxine Waters has is constantly raising it. And I remember when she first raised it and she got the memo, I wrote a column on it in the New York Daily News. But for the most part, it has not gotten very much attention. And how pivotal is this this memo to your lawsuit?
Well, it's one of the three primary legs on which the lawsuit stands. And as you point out, Maxine Waters has been one of the few voices crying in the wilderness trying to bring attention to this issue, and which has been completely undercovered by the major media. The lawsuit's based on three key documents or statements. First was in March 16th of last year, March 16th, 1998. The Inspector General of the CIA testified before Congress, and he, this is Frederick Hitz. Frederick Hitz admitted that the CIA knew about dozens of people involved in narcotics trafficking, and they failed to report this to law enforcement, and that this was wrong, that this served no good purpose, that they didn't have the right to do that. So they admitted wrong on the record under oath. Then, in April, the secret agreement was released, and the secret agreement was made in 1982, so it lay hidden for 16 years. In the secret agreement, the director of the CIA and the head of the Department of Justice, the then Attorney General, they signed this agreement saying that the CIA did not have the duty to report drug trafficking to law enforcement. And, of course, they can't do that. I mean, that's like having your kids say, "Hi, Mom, I've just changed my bedtime till midnight." You know, only the people in the Congress can change the law. A government agency can't go and say, wave a wand and say, "Oh, this law doesn't apply to us. We don't have to report drug crimes," because the CIA was required to report drug crimes, both by the executive order, which prompted the secret agreement, and by a federal statute.
And when you say report drug crimes, you mean that CIA assets involved with drug crimes?
Well, there's actually several laws involved. A federal statute 28, United States Code 535, imposes a duty on every department and agency in the executive branch to report information about violations of criminal law by officers and employees of the government. But then there's also an executive order issued in 1981, Executive Order 12333, which all through it talks about reporting drug crimes, and it asks the CIA and the Department of Justice to set up procedures for doing that. Both the statute and the executive order are clearly aimed at people following the law and at narcotics violations being communicated so that law enforcement can do its job. It's not neither of these were designed to enable or facilitate the CIA to keep silent, to hide information that was needed to protect communities and people's lives. But the secret agreement tried to twist things to its advantage by redefining common language. For example, they redefined the word employee in the secret agreement to mean only career CIA officials, as opposed to agents in the field or assets or informants or all these other people on the CIA payroll. I mean, normally, if somebody's on your payroll, they're your employee, right? But the secret agreement redefines employee to mean hardly any of these people on the payroll, but just a small proportion of CIA officials.
We're talking to Katya Komisaruk, attorney representing the plaintiffs in this novel suit against the CIA and the Justice Department that sues them for failing to stop the introduction of crack cocaine into the communities of Oakland and South Central Los Angeles. Also on the phone with us is Olivia Woods, who is a plaintiff in the Oakland suit. Olivia Woods, how did you get involved with this case?
Well, I've been interested in the epidemic and the addiction that's been happening in my community for a long time. And I wanted to find a way that to bring the light to the issue so that some changes could be made.
Now, you'd have to be personally affected to be part of the class action suit.
Oh, yes. My son died from an overdose in 87, leaving three children that I've had to reinvent myself and my life to raise. I'm 71 years old. I had a grandson also 4 years ago to die. I've had numerous acquaintances to lose their children. And just in the drive-by shootings, death in the community, I've experienced it all. It's a horrific story.
And Olivia Woods, what was your initial reaction once these articles began to be published about the involvement of our government in one way or another with the very people who were spreading this crack scourge?
Oh, I felt excited, an opportunity, a chance to really inform people and let other community people know that there is hope and that we can make a difference. And so I stepped out to bring my light to the darkness and help others in my community and throughout to come forward.
What do you hope will come out of this suit?
Justice for us, money to rebuild our communities, a life for our children that are growing up in these neighborhoods, and to give us an opportunity to redesign our lives as a community, as a people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Olivia Woods, plaintiff in the Oakland lawsuit against the federal government, and also Katya Kamisarek, attorney representing Olivia Woods. And how many others, Katya?
Well, this lawsuit will represent millions of people because although there are a few named plaintiffs, class representatives, the number of people who lived in the affected communities in South Central Los Angeles and Compton and in the North and East Palo Alto, San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland, Richmond. There are huge African-American communities here and others who were devastated by the crack epidemic. It killed the children and the adults. The crime rose. The businesses fled. The tax base was undermined. Healthcare went to pieces, and the schools became such dangerous, desolate places that students couldn't learn.
Well, Katya Kamisarek, I want to thank you for being with us as well. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is broadcast on the web at www.pacifica.org. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Robert Knight. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcast from the studios of WBAI in New York.